When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey there. Before you start listening, please make sure to subscribe to this podcast. This episode contains language and content of an explicit nature. Listener discretion is advised. Before a song is released, a record is produced, or a chorus is written, the musicians that write them think a lot. They live a lot, and they feel a lot. Before the Chorus dives into the stories and experiences that shape these artists and, ultimately, the music we hear.
I'm your host, Sophia Lobercaro, and this episode's guest is Merrick Winter.
It's made me grow as a performer and as a writer as well, to just believe in ideas and believe in the power of mistakes actually communicating more humanity. You have to get to the point where you can sit down in front of a mic and just decide that maybe take three was the one and just move on, even though it's not perfect, and accept that people will accept you for that.
Hey there, welcome back to the podcast. It's me, Sophia. Glad to have you here again, hopefully. And if you're new, welcome. Hopefully you'll stick around. Where to begin this week? It was quieter, I guess, overall. I mean, you know, last episode came out right after Thanksgiving, so, you know, there wasn't really much to report. Things were all kind of dwindling down for the long weekend, so, you know, not a lot of exciting things to talk about. I will say, though, this past week, I did actually go to another New School Jams night, which was so much fun. That's the one I talked about a few episodes ago, where they did a Radiohead-themed jam night, which was so incredible. This time was something entirely different. They did a disco-themed night, which was so much fun. One of the things that I love about going to New School Jams is that, obviously, in addition to the incredible musicianship and the performances and the sense of community, there's this kind of sense that you get to dress up for the theme a little bit. You know, like, everyone showed up in glitter. I wore these, like, bright orange flare pants with, like, chunky white patent leather shoes, and I wore all the glitter on my face. And what I love about it is that it doesn't come across as, you know, like, superficial or obnoxious. It comes across as just getting to express yourself through fashion. And especially if the theme leans into camp a little bit, like, I missed this one, but I know they did a Lady Gaga theme. People really dressed on that theme and really went all out. And I think that, as I sort of preach on this podcast, especially about music, you know, being able to let go and do things kind of to their full extent on full volume just because they make you happy is such a precious thing. So getting to go to this event and reveling in the music, but also giving yourself fully to the theme and be camp, be silly, be creative with fashion while you, again, also are dancing in this sweaty room, It just kind of, all of it adds to the experience. Also, they had some unbelievable horn players this week. I think they're friends of Jay Flatt, one of the organizers of the event, and they just absolutely blew my mind. It took me right back to being around the South London jazz scene with these incredible riffs and improvisations. Yeah. Oh my God. I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you're in LA and you're not coming to New School Jam nights, what are you doing? You need to start coming to them. Otherwise, what else can I tell you? This is a bit of a random one, but I went to go and take myself on a solo date to the new Hunger Games movie, which might not sound relevant, but stick with me for a second. They wrote a bunch of songs for this movie, a lot of them inspired by, like, Appalachian folk. And they're really, really, really good. Also, Rachel Zegler has one of the most incredible voices I have ever heard. And even though she has a musical theater background, she suits like traditional folk music so unbelievably well. You know, it's interesting when you see songs that are written for a film, or in this case, a book initially that and then were made for a film. You know, you wonder if they're going to be up to par, if they're going to be a more watered down version of whatever they're referencing. And it really doesn't feel like that. They did such a brilliant job writing songs that feel like they could have been around forever, that had depth and nuance and real, like the real poetry of folk music was present in these songs. So that was a really, really pleasant surprise from watching this film. And it's just kind of gotten me into a little bit of a folk phase recently, which is ideal because this week's guest is very much in the world of folk, Merrick Winter. I met Merrick about a year ago through my friend's Flight, who, if you listen to this podcast a lot, you may know have been on the podcast twice. About a year ago, I went to meet up with the Flight guys at a local pub, German pub, but it's as close as we could get to a British pub, so we took it. And I get there, and all of these different musicians that I knew from the UK that just so happened to be here in Los Angeles were all there. And so we had this sort of like UK plus, in my case, UK adjacent hangout. I lived in London for many years. I'm very close to the London music scene, and I also just love hanging out with British people. I have a very dry sense of humor that is very akin to theirs. So anyway, I had the loveliest time, and Merrick was one of the people I met there. We talked a bunch about the music that we like and just sort of clicked on that, and so he became a friend. And then a year later, we got in touch again. I went to go and see him a few weeks ago playing at the Virgil here in LA, a really great little venue in East Hollywood. It was incredible getting to see him perform with a full band. His sound is, I mean, folk at its heart, but with a lot of complex and rich arrangements that sort of fill it up beautifully. Think Andy Schoaf, Bon Iver, even at moments, Paul Simon, a little bit of George Harrison, all sort of blended together. So you have this sort of like more Americana grassroots side to the music, as well as the sort of like lush expansiveness that you hear a lot in modern indie folk. So it's a beautiful, beautiful mixing of worlds. We had a lot of really interesting things to talk about in this episode, things around masculinity and Merrick's very unique childhood in a small town in Iowa founded largely around transcendental meditation. So I'm not going to spoil any more than that. I think the best thing I can do now is leave you to my interview with Merrick. Even though there's some songs on this EP that feel more like they're about a separate character, some that feel a lot more personal, the overarching theme that I felt like I was catching, whether this was intentional or not, was a lot of the characters feel like they're either stuck and or lonely.
This is an interesting observation. It's also fascinating to hear someone else's observation reflected back at you.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of these songs were, they were a collection over time. There's a couple of them that were from the pandemic, and I suppose that would kind of check out. But it certainly wasn't an intentional arc. But I think sometimes when you put a series of works together and then you step back, you zoom out and you look at them and you, oh, there is the arc. Mm-hmm. There is what I was feeling.
Yeah.
And in the moment when you're writing them or you're experiencing them, it's not necessarily clear. But it's a good observation, and it's probably true. I think the character study wise, those kind of people I find very interesting to write about. There's a song called Mr. Resistor that's pure observation for me, and that one kind of stands out in the way you observe. But
absolutely.
I think I kind of randomly put, not randomly, I do everything very on purpose. I put Mr. Resister and Try Me in a sort of similar category in that they both felt like songs that dealt with something within masculinity. And whereas one just kind of continues to go through the motions and sort of stay stagnant, like Mr. Resister, the other one hits a breaking point that ends in tragedy. Just like being so like stuck that something just snaps and a horrible thing happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never thought of them as being akin to one another, but I suppose, yeah, I was thinking about masculinity for both songs. Try Me was interesting. I went away on a writing solo kind of writing retreat. My family friends live in Sweden in the woods, and I tried to collect as many songs as I could and finish things. And I was there for 6 days, and I just didn't finish anything. And then on the last night, I had a chat with my host, and we started talking about this tragedy that had happened in my hometown, where I was born in the Midwest, believe it or not. And it got me thinking about masculinity and how it can go wrong, and how from an early age, the neglect of emotions and of vulnerability, of being allowed to express your feelings, boys don't cry. A lot of these things, if left unchecked without a role model, a male role model that can, you know, show you that those things are okay, potentially can manifest in violent behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of just trying to explore that from a personal experience of actually knowing or having met this person who did this thing in my hometown. I didn't know them well, but the story just got me thinking about the broader issues of, for example, like gun crime in America, and, you know, schools and all that. It's personal to me because I'm half American, but also observing it from a British perspective is bewildering. I spent most of my time in England, and you look at it and you go, how does this happen every day? And then it happens in, you know,
yeah,
the town I grew up in. But masculinity, definitely. And on the side of Mr. Resister, I think, that was a character study that was born of just a particularly creative day. And sometimes you just have a day where you're walking around and everything is like, I'm taking that. That's inspiring. I like that. Doesn't happen all the time. But on this particular day, I was walking past a light shop on a English high street, and it was just called Mr. Resister. Hope I don't get sued.
I think you'll be fine.
I think I'll be all right. Yeah. And I just wondered, who is this man? Who is this man? And it just turned into a sort of character study of a lonely figure. And I think in a lot of ways, we probably all know one. Maybe it's your uncle, maybe it's your dad, maybe it's your brother, maybe it's your neighbor, the mm-hmm. chap that lives across the road. And in a funny way, I was also exploring what it would look like if I never went to therapy and completely shut down and completely closed myself off and, you know, just watched the telly and had my slippers. And, you know, it's not directly a self-explorative thing. It's definitely more of a character study, but yeah, there's definitely an exploration of this sort of British bulldog masculinity, keeps himself to himself, you know, like
mm-hmm.
it's maybe like, voted for Brexit.
Probably. It's given, I mean, I know this is such a, like, it became like such an international meme, but it's the very like stiff upper lip, keep calm, carry on.
Absolutely. Kind of. And that permeates across British society, especially when it comes to masculinity. I think it doesn't matter whether you're upper class or working class, which I still find, you know, strange that exists. Yeah. Having moved from America at a young age, learning about that. But that stiff upper lip thing exists all the way across society. And what that manifests essentially is keep calm, carry on, that holdover of the war. It still exists. And I think there's only just have I started having conversations with my male friends where it's like, oh yeah, my therapist told me something, blah, blah, blah. And it's normal.
Yeah.
It's normal. I mean, it took me a very long time to realize the benefits of doing that. And I think this record is a chronicling of me. I think, yeah, when I, the first song that I wrote, which was Veneer, which is the last song on the EP, was around the time I started going to therapy. So I came to it late, and I think a lot of guys do.
I think that's, I mean, yeah, that's extremely normal, but it's been refreshing to witness. Like, for me, I mean, I have a very particularly close relationship with therapy because I was diagnosed with OCD when I was 11. And so I've been in therapy since I was young. And I remember when my parents first, you know, when I was a kid and they saw me having like a panic attack because like I felt like my heart was beating too fast. And they were like, okay, you should go to therapy. And I remember being like, oh my God, my parents like want to put me in an institution. They think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
And the reason I say this is because I have such a like an intimate relationship with the concept of therapy and how vital it's been to me as a person, I've also got to very closely watch how views of therapy have transformed over the last 15 years or so. You know, like now, like people on like dating apps very proudly write, I go to therapy. Like it's like a green flag of yeah. like, see, yeah. I'm emotionally intelligent. I don't repress things because yeah. I have a therapist. Whereas years ago, especially for men, it was like, no, like I'm not talking about that shit.
Oh, I still encounter it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I still have conversations with friends of mine where there is resistance and it's understandable. It's, I remember feeling reticent to admit that I needed it because a lot of the reasons why you would need to go can become so subliminal and so much a part of your day-to-day consciousness, your psyche, that you just end up thinking, oh, well, that's just the way I think, or that's normal, or I guess everyone thinks this way, or because everyone feels like they can't get out of bed,
yeah.
you know. And the truth is that, you know, you can normalize things. You can normalize recurring thought patterns, negative thought patterns, and normalize behaviors like Mr. Resister. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's also the play on that title is resistance itself.
Yeah,
which is I think it was a Stephen Pressfield book that I first discovered that The War of Art.
Oh, I've read part of The War of Art.
Yeah.
But yeah, resistance is a big part of it.
I think, well, probably the reason you didn't finish it was resistance.
You're ironically not wrong. Actually.
Searching for it on the bookshelf. Oh, there it is.
Yeah, I was like, I know I have it because a friend of mine was like, you have to read this book. And I was like, it's literally like a foot behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where that's why when I saw that sign, there was a click.
Yeah.
And I was like, ah. I can work with this.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Resister doesn't know about resistance.
Exactly.
He doesn't even think that therapy is a thing that's available outside of an institution. It's
no.
There's something that shifted in culture, and I'm grateful for it, and I'm especially grateful to a lot of my female friends and my partners. Actually, previous partners for encouraging me to do that because it changed my life. I'm really preaching here now.
Yay. I mean, I'll
come on,
I'll
boys
take it.
Come on, boys, open up,
everybody, go to therapy. Yes, especially boys. Y'all deserve it. I won't just say y'all need it, but I think everyone deserves that sort of freedom that you get through therapy, so you don't end up feeling again stagnant like a Mr. Resister, feeling like you need a break. Or like you're going to break like the character and Try Me.
Yeah. There was a period in the pandemic where I felt like I couldn't feel anything from music at all. And it was because there was no connection to audiences and no feedback, and it was, you know, operating in a vacuum. It was a very creative period, but also, you know, difficult for everyone, obviously. But I therapy pulled me out of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And on that note, everyone go to therapy. I think I know where. Yeah, I want to go next to Field of Dreams, but I kind of want to take a quick, somewhat, I guess, unscripted stop, because I didn't initially write about this, but like, this is also the second song on the record that references Iowa, because I know it's where you're, like, where you're from, but yeah. Like, even though you haven't, I remember you telling me the other day you haven't been back in a long time, but you still seem to have, like, such a strong connection and a reverence for it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's a strange place to have been born. and people never quite believe me when they're like, oh, where are you from? And I say, I live in London. And oh, where were you born? You know, you get the conversation gets there and you go, oh, I was born in Iowa. People go, yeah, right. No, really. I was born in a very small college town. And it was, the university was founded by this guru in the 60s called Maharishi. And the town is based around this practice of transcendental meditation. So a lot of spiritual seekers and a lot of ex-hippies and people who want to live an alternative lifestyle move there. It was the thing the Beatles did, when they went to India and started growing beards and playing the sitar.
Yeah, India, Iowa, yeah. Same.
Exactly, same thing.
It's interchangeable.
Yeah. But so I grew up, you know, with a lot of strange influences, a lot of world music, a lot of folk music that was, you know, part of that that movement in the 60s, just kind of transferred, and people would roll through town, like strange celebrities. Like, I remember seeing Donovan, the folk singer Donovan, in our local cafe. Moby would roll through and play gigs. David Lynch would come and give talks on meditation. Yeah.
I didn't know he meditated.
There's a thing called the David Lynch Foundation. And it's basically set up an organization to teach transcendental meditation to people in the military and convicts. And basically it's a rehabilitation technique. Mm. And I'm a huge David Lynch fan. You know, regardless of that, but there was just some strange sort of unlikely encounters I had with the arts in this tiny Iowan town. So it was like there was fields and farms, and like there were, you know, people like the townsfolk. There was the townies, and then there was the roos, which stands for gurus.
Mm.
It was very strange. I don't want to describe it as a cult, but if it was a cult, it would be a good one. Although anyone who grew up in a cult would say their cult was a good one.
Yeah, until they end up on a documentary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like the Wild Wild Country thing, except it doesn't end in disaster and
no one was like compiling guns.
Yeah, no, there was not anything like that. No,
well, that's good.
No poisoning, no murdering. But yeah, you know, Indian guru takes over a small Midwestern town. There's a theme. There's a running theme.
There you go.
So that's yeah, my parents. My mom's from England and my dad's from Texas, and they met in that town. And amazing. I was born there. And then I moved to England when I was 12, 11.
Wow. Well, on that note, I mean you mentioned the kind of towny side of this little town in Iowa, and I feel like the imagery of Field of Dreams kind of leans more that way, I guess, just because it's like, I mean, well, yeah. It's quite literally called Field of Dreams, but there's like the sort of idea of like the sunset over the cornfields. Yeah. And then of course, like, again, we spoke about this briefly the other day, but the name does come from the 1989 film starring Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
And even though, again, I remember at that day you said, like, you know, the song itself is not about that song, but what is it about maybe like the sentiment of that movie that made you feel like that was the right name for the song? Or
yeah.
I guess, what's the tie?
The honest truth is that I watched that movie and I hadn't been home in such a long time. It's funny, wow, I just said home. because it still feels like, yeah, it's, I mean, the place that I spent my childhood. And anyway, I hadn't been back to the Midwest in, you know, a decade, and I watched that movie and it just made me sob. And it's not even like, it's not even a particularly good movie. I mean, it's a great movie. It's cheesy, it's very corny, and it's like a Midwestern high fantasy. You know, ghosts coming out of the cornfields. But it just evoked a lot of memories of, like, you know, gravel roads and running through those really high corn stalks that are, like, when you're a kid, they tower way, way above you and you can get lost. And, you know, the sun starts to go down and you go, oh, we better get out. But then maybe you push a few stalks down and you lie there and you look up and the stars come out and the crickets are singing and maybe someone has a joint, you know. And I don't know, I hadn't been back for such a long time that the movie really got to me. And then another hometown tragedy that I was just thinking about. So clearly it was on my mind, and I think, yeah, the pandemic probably made me think about it quite a lot, because this is a relatively old song as well.
It definitely, I mean, I know there's a piece of the film that also deals with, like, someone who's grieving, you know.
Yeah.
And there's, even though it's clearly not taking that character's story and putting it in the song, there is that sort of through line as well, where there's a sense of loss that's kind of, again, woven through.
I think something that really got to me was the ghosts coming out of the field, you know. That image, for some reason, just got to me. And that, the inspiration behind the song was just, lost some family friends in a car accident. Just a, you know, there's something that happens, but it came up, and the movie really triggered it. But there's also another element with that song, I think. Other Midwestern artists like Bon Iver have really inspired me. I think Bon Iver was like a huge thing for me. And for a long time I thought, when I moved to England, like, that being, having this part of my identity, like, half American, was like, I didn't necessarily need to talk about it. Like, nothing happens in the Midwest. Like, oh, like, Bill Bryson has this great quote. He says, "I come from Des Moines, somebody had to." And he's, you know, wonderful, eloquent writer, and blah, blah, blah. And but yeah, I definitely feel like I wanted to give voice to a part of my life that I'd forgotten with this couple of the songs on this EP.
Yeah, it's so funny, because I remember I told you that I was like, Field of Dreams sounds very much like Bon Iver and the sort of soundscapes and that. And I forgot for a moment that Justin is from, I think, is it Wisconsin that he's from?
Yeah, it's pretty close to where I was born.
Yeah, so that's, it kind of adds a whole other layer that I didn't even think about, that it, the fact that it sounds like something coming from such a wonderful artist from the Midwest, and it's such a vivid image of the Midwest, like, it just, I don't know, it's cool to, like, kind of clock an additional layer to it.
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said that record wasn't a pretty big deal for me.
Yeah.
There's that album cover as well, of the self-titled.
Yeah.
Just seared into my brain. I think it evokes something, a sort of homesickness for me as a teenager in England, trying to figure out an entirely new culture and, like, assimilating in English schools and, like, not having all of the reference points necessarily. Listening to that record and hearing him kind of sing about, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan and things named after states and towns, and a kind of collage and a kaleidoscope of memories that aren't necessarily all discernible. That's something I love about his lyricism. It sparked something in me. And that's, I've carried that pretty much for my whole musical life, that record.
Yeah, I think there's something cool, like, it almost makes it feel like it's hitting your subconscious rather than just your conscious, when this sort of, as you said, like the memories that he's describing feel so blurry. And even makes me think of like when I was watching the video for Mr. Resistor, which was made with AI, and AI does that like funny thing that like it makes these like human forms, but they're always just like a little bit off. And then of course, like the image kind of continues to morph into like various versions. And it kind of gave this like one, this sort of like everyman quality and like a universality to it. Cause like there's many forms of this same type of person, but in that same way, because it's sort of abstract too, it hits on that like subconscious feeling of like, I recognize this, and it doesn't have to be like perfectly worded. I guess also because then that can also be very specific to an individual person, but when it's in that abstract, it's like it kind of hits more the sentiment that we all feel around either, you know, knowing a character like a Mr. Resistor, or dealing with nostalgia and thinking of like the memories of childhood, whatever it is, it kind of makes it more universal.
Yeah, it's an archetype. I think with character writing, you're trying to distill something about the human essence, about the universality in a stranger that you might be observing, or someone you know well. But I think with any good song, you're trying to think about what it is you can learn from other people and communicate that in a way so that the listener hears something about themselves or someone they know. You use the lens of the personal to reach the universal somehow. If you're doing a good job, that's what McCartney did so well. Yep. I think.
Absolutely. I think on that note, we're going to go to another two songs that I kind of grouped together, which were Stalemate and Eve of Disaster. Probably mostly because like they both deal with breakdowns in communication within relationships.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, again, I talked about at the top of this, like, the idea of someone who's kind of, like, feeling stuck or feeling lonely. It feels like, again, like, both the sort of songs deal with some kind of stuckness within a relationship of just, like, I'm stuck in this situation where I can't figure out how to relate to this other person, or maybe this relationship is about to fall apart and there's nothing I can do.
Mm.
And there's also that sense of being lonely within your own relationship because, again, you can't talk to the other person. So
yeah.
Anyway, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, and if you'd be willing to unpack that as a songwriter.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting that you group them together. I've always thought of them as kind of their own entities, but in truth, they were probably born out of similar emotions. I think Stalemate came about, my friend Elizabeth Wolfe came to visit my studio in London. She's based in LA, she's a great songwriter, and I think we were both having a rough day in our relationships in respective ways, and she came in with an idea and I just latched onto it immediately. It was, you know, this, I just wish you needed me more. Like being shut out and trying your absolute hardest to show up, to be kind, to be attentive, to listen, even to learn about things to do with mental health that you're not experienced with, and just to try and show up in the best way for a partner, and for sometimes that to just not work. You just can't get through. There's a lot of language in Stalemate that has to do with being trapped or stuck or unsure of where next to turn. So that really resonated with me. I think she brought that line, I wish she needed me more. And I think she really enabled me to be quite vulnerable, which is another reason that I really love co-writing. Because you get someone else's day, someone else's life experiences, someone else's sensibilities, and someone else's bravery, because they might be brave enough to go somewhere, and if they say, look, maybe let's go here together, you're far more willing to do it and explore a thing that maybe your mind wouldn't have, you know, it might not have gone there. So I remember with Stalemate, we probably wrote it in an afternoon, and I whacked out. we got slightly stuck in the middle of the session, I think. I was like, let me just go grab my journal. And I went to my journal, and I'd underlined this particularly difficult day. I'd underlined all this like imagery. I was feeling particularly verbose on that day.
Oh boy.
I was like writing in, you know, metaphors and all this stuff. And so a lot of the verses, like locked in a war of wills, antlers silently clashing, stirring up the dust, what's the use in asking? All that sort of, yeah, a lot of the imagery from that song came from a journal entry, and it was done in a day. And then I sat on it for ages because we were both in those relationships at the time. And it was like, well, that was cathartic, but we probably won't play that to anyone for a while. And then my producer, Matt Zara, who's an absolute genius and one of my favorite creative people, excellent at recording to tape, sat me down and said, have you got any songs? And I said, maybe this one. This one might be a good one. I've forgotten about it. And I played it to him. He's like, yeah, let's do it. And he just like arms the tracks. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm fully done. He's like, no, man, it'll be fine. Don't worry. Let's just record it. And I put a camera up because that's what he and I do. We just like film our little tape sessions. And I didn't think it would be the final record, but we listened to it back and it sounded so honest, mostly to do with the fact that me and Elizabeth got somewhere really honest with it, but also because it was live, it was all recorded live to tape, all the instruments, and you can watch it. Yeah, and the take that is the live video is the take.
Promotion.
You can watch it. but that's a workflow that I've really come to love, and it's made me grow as a performer and as a writer as well, to just believe in ideas and believe in the power of mistakes actually communicating more humanity. Because, you know, also as a producer, I've been guilty of perfectionism and overwrought and, you know, overdoing things. This is where, you know, this is how we learn. You have to get to the point where you can sit down in front of a mic and just decide that maybe take three was the one and just move on, even though it's not perfect, and accept that people will accept you for that. So that, I mean, that was how Stalemate came about. And Eve of Disaster was the polar opposite in terms of production. It's like this huge thing. It took a month. Me and Justin Glasgow worked on it here in LA, and it was a joy. It was so much fun to record and you know, getting strings on it. My friend Emiko played strings, and it's a real production, and a lot more thought went into the music as well. And I'm not sure which one encapsulates the emotion better. I think they're doing different jobs.
I'd agree.
Yeah, but they come from the, you're absolutely right, they come from the same emotional center.
Yeah, there is a sense in both of like someone being shut out from the other person in the relationship. Yeah. Like, again, there's a rift, and yeah, so they play out differently, but that's definitely at the core of both of them.
Yeah, that song Eve came from I just had the title. I don't know where it just came into my head. Eve Disaster, that might even be a kind of colloquial thing, I don't really know, but it had a nice ring to it because we've been living through, I feel like our generation's just been living through crisis after crisis of, oh, here's another impending disaster that's about to happen. Oh, here's another one. Oh, another one. Oh, good. Okay, yeah. Well, somewhere I was still alive. And actually living through a lot of them, like very serious ones.
Yeah.
So that was where the title came from. But then, similar to Mr. Resistor, I was like, who's Eve? Who could she be? And yeah, it's maybe people I know, an amalgam of people, but for me the emotion is less defined with Eve. I know to this day, slightly less about what I'm trying to say with it and more about how it makes me feel, which sometimes I like with lyrics, is it doesn't all necessarily have to make sense. Sometimes it can be a vignette or a series of vignettes or collage.
Yeah.
You know?
That's kind of how I felt about Veneer when I heard it, because especially like as half of my job is often lyrical analysis, that's both my favorite song on the record and the hardest one to crack, I find. Really? Just because I find the lyrics are the most like abstract, but I do know that like the first time I heard it, something about it moved me, even though I can't necessarily make out exactly what it's about, and we can talk about that now. But yeah, it's true, sometimes it is just about some, like I said before, it's like almost like it hits your subconscious in like a funny way and
yeah,
and does something that you can't quite explain.
Yeah. I like music that does that exact thing just as much as I like music that has perfectly crafted lyrics. And I appreciate them for different reasons. And I also have different moods for those two. Like I turn to Paul Simon for, you know, very well told stories. And, maybe I turn to Bon Iver to feel a kind of kaleidoscope hit my subconscious, you know. Don't need to know what it's about. I think with Veneer, if I remember, let's see, what was I doing? I was sitting on a rooftop in Barcelona. That's where I wrote that. And it was just an acoustic guitar. And I was thinking about conversations I've had with various friends and friends of friends, are people who are kind of burned out. Some friends who are in very high paying, fast paced 9-to-5 jobs, and a creeping numbness that seemed to be approaching. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but a sense of like lacking purpose, or that money wasn't quite the answer. And that there was a facade or a sort of a veneer that can obscure one's vision of why one is doing what one is doing. It's quite a nebulous emotion, I have to be honest. It was a sense of, it's perhaps an element of nihilism going on there, a sense of feeling lost. But that was also the earliest song, and that was written in the pandemic, when the lockdown restrictions lifted in England long enough for people to like go traveling. I went to Barcelona. But yeah, that song is, for me, is as much a production and a sort of soundscape and a feeling as much as it is the lyrical content. Patrick Fitzroy and I worked on that in London. That was the first thing we made together. I was really lucky to work with some great producers on this EP. I didn't really want to do it on my own, because it's far more fun collaborating. And I learned so much from Matt and Justin and Patrick working on it.
Yeah. I think the last thing I'll say is, and maybe this is me being a little bit like, I got it right, but I feel like nihilism is also kind of a form of stuckness. And also, like, I think Mr. Resister also has that sort of, like, nihilism of just doing things for the sake of doing things without having any kind of deeper meaning to it, so...
Yeah, just going about your day.
Yeah, literally. So...
Down at the car boot fair.
I guess, yeah. Maybe I'm just feeling a little bit cocky. It's like, I was right. So a lot of that same theme throughout the EP.
You took a bet and it paid off.
It did. Swung for the fence. You know, whatever. That's a baseball analogy. Looping in Field of Dreams.
There we are.
Eve of Disaster is available now wherever you normally get your music. This podcast is hosted, edited, and produced by myself, Sophia Lopercaro, and the artwork is by Meg Wilford.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. Hey, podcast listener. Do you love talking about movies, music, TV, comics, and games? Then you should be listening to The Great Pop Culture Debate, back and bigger than ever for Season 9. This season, the panelists discuss the best James Bond film, the best Elton John single, the best Nickelodeon original series, the best Batman villain, and so much more. Find the show wherever you listen to podcasts, or head to greatpopculturedebate.com. More than 100 topics are already available. Subscribe today.